You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the Dreaming. Now, on today's show, I'm not going to go too much into the history of Palestine, although we will touch on it at certain points. And I'm not going to, you know, repeat a lot of the same talking points that you're no doubt going to hear on other programs on 3CR or that you might have heard, you know, elsewhere. Instead, we're going to have a bit more of a confrontational discussion, a bit more of a challenging discussion, so maybe a better term to use, where instead we're going to look at the ongoing complicity of so many people on the so-called left and in so-called progressive spaces, as well as a lot of the normalization that continues to prevail. You know, this is a part of the whole combating liberalism theme that I've been speaking about over the last few episodes. But there are so many liberal tendencies that exist in the pro-Palestine space. And, you know, these liberal tendencies, they don't actually help anyone except for the Zionist entity. So we're going to be talking a bit about that today. First off, I want to talk a bit about Australia and Australia's role here. So, again, I'm not going to get too much into it. If you're a regular listener of this show or a regular listener of 3CR, no doubt you're probably aware of the role that Australia plays in upholding and enabling that genocide. You know, I'm talking about all the weapons manufacturers that operate here that turn my people's stolen resources into, you know, armaments and ammunition and bombs and weapon components and whatever else, as well as the role that the Australian government plays in, you know, hosting spy bases like Pine Gap, as well as all the other logistical support they provide to Israel through the Five Eyes surveillance programs and, you know, all of these other things that Australia does to aid Israel. Now, instead, I'm going to be talking a bit about how there is this whole persuasion on the left, even today, even 2 years into a live stream genocide, there's this whole persuasion on the left where people still think that they can appeal to the Australian government to stop its support of Israel. You know, the Australian government, it's not a neutral bystander here. It's a colonial state itself, just like Israel, whose entire existence depends on the same imperial systems that sustain Zionism. You know, appealing to end its complicity in genocide assumes that Australia can be morally persuaded, but it acts in accordance with its own material interests. Interests that are imperial, extractive, and anti-indigenous. You know, we have to remember this. You know, Australia isn't some moral state. You know, Australia doesn't have morals. Australia is Israel, just 150 years older. And that's what people really need to reconcile with here. You know, we live in, to phrase Uncle Robbie Forbes, you know, we live in the big West Bank here. It's been this way for decades now, and prior to that, it was very much like Gaza, where we had all of these settlers and these different militias and armies and whatever have you coming in and committing wide-scale massacre, committing, you know, mass starvation, putting people into concentration camps, and doing all these other nasty, disgusting, genocidal acts. We have to remember that. You know, the call should not be for Australia to stop supporting Israel. It should be that Australia is Israel. You know, these are the same entities at the end of the day. And that is why it was actually Australia who went and committed stuff like the Surafan massacre in the two decades leading up to the foundation of the Zionist state. You know, to clear the land there of Palestinians and of Turks and of other Arab peoples so that these Zionist settlers could go and set up in the first place. And it was also Australia who first proposed the recognition of the Israeli state in the UN. And Australia was, I think, the second or the third after the US to vote on the recognition of Israel as a state. You know, these things cannot be forgotten. There's nothing to be won by appealing to Australia to somehow take a moral stance. And, you know, let's not forget that Australia's own genocidal history isn't just in the past, it's very much the present. You know, this is still the state that has the highest incarcerated population in the world. You know, the mass ethnic incarceration of my people. This is still a state that steals 1 in 4 Aboriginal children, that continues to steal all of our resources as well, $500 billion worth of resources a year, that continues to occupy our lands, that continues to use its death squad police forces to murder our people in custody. You know, there's nothing to be won by trying to appeal to Australia. That is not the way it works. And people need to reconcile with that. Now, building on that, you know, another thing that I quite often hear on the so-called left is how Albanese is a coward for the role that he plays here and for his refusal to, you know, properly condemn Israel and to stop supporting Israel and whatever have you. Now, you know, that's, again, it's a misnomer, it's a misread. You know, the left keeps calling Albanese a coward, but he's not spineless. He's consistent. His government position is not moral weakness, it's ideological loyalty. He doesn't fear confrontation with Israel because he willingly supports Israel. His project is to secure Australia's place in the Western Imperial Bloc, and Israel is a part of that same bloc. Framing him as a coward turns a structural truth into a personal failing when it is not. It lets the system off the hook by pretending the problem is one man's moral courage instead of the settler state's political DNA. You know, we have to recognize these sorts of things. We have to accept them and understand them. Because at the end of the day, Albanese is not a coward for, you know, failing to condemn Israel. He is in aligned with these people. You know, he's in the same block as them. These are his allies. He's not a coward. He is sticking to his morals, not the right word to use, but, you know, his own morals and his own ethics here. And that is what we have to reconcile with. You know, it's not that he's too much of a coward to stand up to Israel. Is that he wants to be aligned with Israel. And another thing on that topic, you know, this whole recent recognition of Palestine, it's just a hollow colonial gesture. Recognition from a settler colony is not about liberation and it's not about ending genocide. It's about containment and it's about these states trying to wash the blood off their hands. But at the end of the day, you know, we know that Australia only so-called recognises Palestine in a form that is acceptable to imperial order. You know, it recognises the 1967 borders. It recognises the co-opted and puppet leadership of the Palestinian Authority, you know, and the so-called peace process. It doesn't recognise the right of return. It doesn't recognise the legitimacy of armed struggle, or the existence of a free Palestine in all of its proper original territories, you know, from the river to the sea. This recognition is 76 years too late and still manages to undermine the very principle it pretends to support. You know, it's not about solidarity, it's about damage control, and it's about further empowering the Zionist occupation. You know, this is the same sort of crap that we see here when we have the Australian government, you know, so-called acknowledging country here. It's nothing more than a symbolic gesture that costs the colonisers nothing, while the colonisers get to keep the land, keep the power, and keep their weapons. You know, these are things that we all have to reconcile with here. These are things that we have to understand. There's no point patting Albanese or patting ourselves on the back because Australia went and recognised, apparently recognised Palestine. You know, we have to really look at what they're recognising here. Look at the caveats that it comes with. Look at the way they're recognising it. They're not supporting armed resistance. They're not supporting a proper free Palestine that's free of Zionist influence and control. They're still recognising Israel and all the land that Israel has taken and continues to occupy. You know, we have to do better.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Now, today is one day after the two-year anniversary of the Alaska flood. And on today's episode, I'm talking a bit about the failures of the so-called progressive left here in Australia in regards to the last 2 years of genocide that we have seen live streamed to us out of Gaza. Now, I'm going to continue the conversation up next. So, you know, I'm going to talk a bit about the trade unions and their failures. Now, you know, another thing that I have noticed over the last 2 years is, and you know, this is still happening today, mind you, you know, 2 years on, it's still going on, but this whole way that people keep trying to appeal to the trade unions in so-called Australia to act as if the colonial working class will suddenly turn revolutionary on moral grounds. You know, Australian unions, though, are institutions of the settler proletariat. Their role has always been to defend settlers' economic privilege within empire, not to dismantle the empire itself. Now, there is an author from Turtle Island who wrote a lot about this, Jay Sakai. He wrote the book Settlers, The Myth of the White Proletariat. Now, in his work, he talks about the way that the white working class is not the revolutionary class, it is instead the mass base of imperialism. Now, likewise, it is the same here in so-called Australia. When we look at the unions here, and when we look at the history of the union movement, you know, we really have to factor this in. Now, to give you some context and example and around this, you know, I want to talk a bit about the way that the union movement has failed First Nations peoples here to highlight their complicity in colonization and in empire and their disregard for colonization and indigenous peoples. So, you know, when we look at it from the perspective of First Nations people here, you know, the union movement here has failed my people as well, because it was never built for us. From the very beginning, it was built to protect settler workers and their privileged position in the colonial system, and it has been riddled with colonial chauvinists and racists since day one. Now, you know, people often like to tell stories about the proud history of Australian unions, and they point to moments like the Pilbara strike or the support against South African apartheid as so-called evidence of solidarity, but they always leave out the key details. You know, the key details here are that the support in those moments didn't come from white Australian workers, it came from the wharfies and the maritime unions, which were dominated by people of colour, by migrants, and by internationalists from around the world. And those people brought with them traditions of global working class solidarity. That is the reason why they stood with black people here and in South Africa. It wasn't some natural expression of white Australian unionism. Now, right here we have a contradiction. You know, unions advocated to end apartheid abroad, like in places like South Africa during the 90s. But where is the same advocacy against the apartheid in their own backyards? During the 1990s, while unions were rallying against apartheid, we had apartheid right here, you know, as I just said, in our own backyards. And today it's the same story. First Nations people today are incarcerated here at well over five times the rate that black people in South Africa were incarcerated at during the height of South Africa's apartheid policies. You know, never mind the fact that their apartheid was modelled directly on Australia's policies, like the White Australian Policy and the, you know, Aboriginal Protection Act and Segregation Acts. And on that note, you know, where was the union movement during the era of slavery that happened right here on this continent? You know, slavery existed here and was practiced in various forms right up until the 1970s in some places. First Nations people, alongside Kanak and other South Sea Islanders, were subjected to slavery here, yet there was no mass union movement to confront this. You know, this racism goes right back to before Federation as well. You know, take the Eureka Stockade that people love to hold up as the birthplace of Australian democracy and unionism. You know, look at what they've done there. Many of those exact same miners who took part in the Eureka Stockade also took part in anti-Chinese riots. They murdered Chinese workers. They campaigned for racial exclusion. The stockade became a direct influence on the White Australian policy. And we can't forget that on top of that, those same white miners were also colonists. You know, they were driving genocidal massacres and the mass displacement of First Nations people here in order to steal our land and our resources. And the same can be said of the shearer strikes of the 1890s. You know, again, these are often described as the foundation of the Australian union movement, but who was left out of it? You know, at the same time this was going on, you had First Nations people in the South Sea Islander Kanaks being enslaved and forced to work on the same pastures up in Queensland, the same plantations where a lot of these sheep shearing strikers came from. And, you know, black people up there weren't included in the unions or in the movement. The only exception you'll ever hear named is Andrew Stepney, and he was included because his father was a British naval officer and because he was part African. But at the time, his Aboriginality was conveniently denied or erased by unionists and by all the media of the day. You know, so we need to stop buying into this mythology. Unions here were never moments for all workers. They were movements for settlers. They functioned to protect white wages and white privilege, and they still do today. Now, as I mentioned before, Jay Sakai wrote about this in his book. He argued that unions in the United States were never revolutionary. They weren't portrayed by bad leaders or corrupted over time. Their very foundation was to defend the settler working class. They excluded and attacked Indigenous people, black people, Asians, migrants, you know, all sorts of people over there. And they pushed for racial wage hierarchies. They aligned themselves with US imperialism because empire granted and guaranteed their privileges. You know, what Sakai showed us is that unions didn't just fail to support liberation struggles, but they actively opposed them. They fought against black liberation. They opposed Indigenous sovereignty. They become institutions of empire, not challenges to it. And we see the exact same patterns here. Unions in Australia are bureaucratic. They are tied to the Labor Party. They focus on narrow industrial issues like pay rises and contracts and enterprise agreements, while completely ignoring the bigger picture. They rarely, if ever, touch on sovereignty or decolonization or survival or genocide. They don't take on stuff like climate collapse. They don't confront dispossession. They don't challenge Australia's role as a resource colony feeding imperial powers abroad. Instead, they co-opt our radical energy and they blunt it. They take the words of our struggle and they turn them into slogans for their recruitment campaigns. And they give, you know, symbolic recognition to First Nations, but avoid any real commitment of power or resources. They remain nationalist in their outlook and they remain settler in their core. You know, these are the same unions that backed the voice to Parliament. You know, despite the fact that the initiative was not a grassroots First Nations demand, but was instigated and heavily promoted by Zionist lobby groups, by corporate mining interests, and by other sections of capital. You know, their support reveals a long-standing pattern here, which is aligning with liberal state-sanctioned reforms that secure settler legitimacy rather than standing with genuine First Nations sovereignty. And, you know, by rallying behind a process backed by extractive industries and internationalist interests hostile to decolonization, they once again showed their role as defenders of the colonial system. you know, preferring symbolic recognition over actual meaningful structural change. You know, you've got unions like the CPSU up in the Northern Territory who, you know, openly and covertly back stuff like the use of spit hoods in prisons on children and, you know, shackling kids up to chairs with spit hoods for days at a time because they're more interested in, you know, the so-called rights and safety of the worker. Never mind the fact that the workers committing quasi-war crimes against First Nations kids up there. You know, look at the way that they've got cops in Trade Hall. You know, what's that thing about if you've got a fascist sitting at a table of 10 people, you've got 10 people, 10 fascists sitting around a table? You know, how's that quote go? You know, it's the same sort of thing. These people open the doors to cops to come into Trades Hall. Well, they may as well be cops themselves. You know, they want to sit and dine with fascists. They can be the fascists. You know, and at the end of the day, they don't do anything, as I'm mentioning about Palestine. You know, they don't do anything to really help here. You know, they might appear to voice opposition, but their institutional power continues to uphold the same imperial project over there that is enabling genocide. You know, they've failed to demand the complete arms embargo. They've failed to properly divest from military supply chains or, you know, to stop the support of Israel. You know, where's the tools down in these weapons factories and in these mines? Where's the cause for that? Where's the ban on shipping to Israel? You know, where are the unions doing all this stuff? They're not, because they're too busy tied in with labour and, you know, too busy fattening their pockets with their six-figure salaries. These union leaders, now don't get me wrong, you know, there's rank-and-file members that support the arms embargoes to Israel and, you know, support downing tools and whatever else, but I'm talking about the union leadership here. They're all too busy in bed with labour upholding colonisation and imperialism here and abroad. Because that's what they do. Because that's who they are. And, you know, they come out with these poor excuses and weak excuses about worrying about, you know, being fined or worrying about being deregistered by an illegitimate, illegal colonial entity, which is Australia. You know, too busy worrying about their registrations with a illegal occupation instead of worrying about the actual genocide that is happening over there. You know, these people are worried about being fined out of existence. Meanwhile, we've got people being bombed and starved out of existence. You know, where's their priorities at? Where do their allegiances lay? You know, it's weak and it's disgusting. You know, and it's not just history we're talking about, it's the present here. You know, when we see unions today, they're still more invested in protecting jobs in destructive industries and fighting to stop genocide or fighting to, you know, challenge climate collapse or any of these other things. You know, we have to be realistic here when we're considering this stuff. If they're 2 years in and they still haven't done anything, you know, the union leadership I'm talking about, we're 2 years in and they still haven't done anything, you know, what's the point of continuing to try to appeal to them? You're just wasting your time, wasting your breath and wasting your energy. Accept them for what they are, which is institutes of the colony. Accept that they're not going to, you know, call for these things. And instead, if rank-and-file union members want to get organised, they need to get organised outside of their unions. They need to actually have organised labour, not these bureaucratic institutions that call themselves unions. You know, big difference between the two, by the way, so-called unions and organised labour. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, I encourage people who are listening to go and organise with their fellow workers to have rank-and-file labour organising, but don't put any stock into these institutes, these colonial institutes that are these unions. Don't expect them to do anything. You know, they've sat back and watched the last 2 years of all this genocide happening and they haven't done anything yet. Why are you wasting your breath appealing to them? Go and get organised without them. You don't need them. At the end of the day, a class that benefits from colonisation cannot be relied to end it.
Become a 3CR subscriber today. Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377. Be a part of your community radio station.
Today we're talking a bit about the last 2 years since the Alaska flood. In particular, you know, I'm not talking about exactly what's been happening over there or the history leading up to it. Because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there's plenty of other programs where you'll no doubt hear that sort of information. Instead, on today's episode, we're calling out the normalizers and we're calling out the hypocrisy of the settler colonial left here in so-called Australia and all of their liberal tendencies. You know, just before that song, I was talking a bit about the so-called unions in Australia and their failure to act and to do anything and why that is. You know, up next, I'm going to talk a bit about normalizers. So, you know, something else that I have seen over the last 2 years quite prominently on the so-called left and which I continue to see today is the way that the liberal left continues to platform and legitimize normalizers. Now, when I'm talking about normalizers, I'm talking about those who do stuff like call for a two-state solution, people who condemn the resistance and condemn the Alaska flood of October 7th 2 years ago, you know, people who denounce Hamas and denounce Hezbollah and denounce Ansar Allah and, you know, call these people extremists and whatever else when these people have, you know, even through the eyes of liberal institutions like the UN, these people have a right of resistance. You know, these people continue to demonize and continue to ostracize these resistance factions, even though these resistance factions have every right internationally, you know, under international law, I should say, have every right to do what they do, and they also have every moral and ethical right to resist the genocide and resist occupation. You know, these people have the right to be doing what they're doing and to have done what they have done. People who want to condemn them, people who want to ostracize them or, you know, who want to distance themselves from those people are not allies of the Palestinian struggle. They're not allies of anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggle. They're not allies against occupation. They are tools or fools who instead, through their words, normalize the Zionist occupation of Palestine. You know, these figures exist very much to pacify the conscience of the settler public. You know, they offer empire a Palestinian face that it can tolerate. You know, I'm talking about these in particular people who like to get up there and like to talk about two-state solutions and whatever else. You know, they're there so that people can, liberals I'm talking about when I talk about people, so that liberals can, you know, point to a happy, nice Palestinian face or, you know, happy, nice political face and be like, oh, well, that's the Palestine I support. A Palestine that is still subservient to Israel and Zionist occupation. A Palestine that still enables Israel to exist on Palestinian lands. You know, a Palestine that doesn't actually challenge empire. You know, that's the sort of people that I'm talking about here. You know, these are not people that we should be upholding, and these are not people that we should be, you know, looking towards for our criticisms or our politics in regards to Palestine. You know, when we talk about a two-state solution, it exists to erase the reality of total occupation and ethnic cleansing. You know, it exists to normalize the genocide that has already happened and the land that has already been falsely occupied and claimed by Israel. And, you know, when we've got people that are condemning armed factions, at the end of the day, whether they like it or not, they're siding with empire's monopoly on violence. You know, these are things that we have to recognize here. These are things that we have to accept. You know, every liberation struggle in history has been demonized while it fought, and then it was sanitized only once it was safe. You look at every other decolonial struggle throughout history. You know, and a lot of them, you know, a lot of them still haven't been sanitized. A lot of them are still demonized. You know, people still demonize places like North Korea for daring to stand up against Western invasion and Western occupation and Western imperialism. You know, people still demonize places like Iran for doing the same thing. People demonize places like Vietnam for, again, you know, kicking out the French colonial occupiers and then you know, fighting off the United States Imperial Empire. You know, we're not at the stage of sanitizing resistance yet for Palestine. We are still at the stage of survival, though. You know, normalizers serve the same function as compradors always have. They're intermediaries between the oppressed and the oppressor, translating liberation into language that the colonizer can live with and can accept. You know, there are plenty of these people out today. You know, I'm not going to name them for obvious legal reasons. But you know exactly who I'm talking about, the sort of people I'm talking about. You know, the people that get up and talk about a free Palestine, but in with the caveat of Israel still existing. You know, the people that talk about a two-state solution. The people that get up and demonize the resistance factions, like Hamas, and, you know, like the Yemenis, the Ansar Allah, and, you know, all the stuff that they're doing to actually stop the shipments from getting into Israel where they can. You know, that's the real BDS right there, the Yemenis. You know, they're actually physically boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning these ships from being able to go into Israel. You know, if only we had more people like that in the world. If only we had people like that here in this colony. People who were willing not just to go block a dock, but were willing to, you know, actually take matters into their own hands to prevent a genocide from happening. You know, something that is perfectly legal under international law, by the way. Resistance to genocide by any means necessary is legal under international law. So, you know, I'm not talking about doing anything illegal here on this radio show. I'm just talking about international law and the way it functions. And at the end of the day, you know, there's, as I'm talking about it though, with these normalizers, you know, there's these people that denounce these people. They actually go out, and even like the block the dock people. You know, there's people that denounce people going down blocking the dock and going down picketing weapons factories. You know, people that worry about getting the workers offside. Who cares about getting the workers offside? If the workers want to arm genocide, they should be offside. You know, who wants to be in the same team as people who are actually arming genocide heirs to undertake genocide and slaughter? Why would you care about what those workers think? If those workers had any morals or ethics, had any conscience, they would down their tools and quit their jobs. They wouldn't still be there working to do what they do. You know, I'm sick of hearing all this nonsense about, you know, trying to get the workers on side. It's 2 years into a genocide. These people know what's happening. It's not a case of just needing to educate the workers. You know, everyone knows what's happening over there. And if you don't, you've been living under a rock for the last 2 years, completely oblivious to everything. But people know what's happening over there. You know, you're still trying to win people onto your side. People aren't already on your side. Likely they'll never be. You know, that's the facts that we've got to reconcile with here. But yeah, there's all of these normalizers. And, you know, they even exist within our politicians as well. I'm not just talking about within the organizing community, but, you know, all these people like the Greens, for example. You know, the Greens, on the one hand, sure, they may or may not condemn the genocide that Israel is undertaking. But at the same time, they also condemn the Alaska flood. They condemn Hamas. They condemn these resistance factions. And they call for stuff like a two-state solution, which still allows the illegal occupation and Zionist entity to retain Palestinian lands. You know, that's not solidarity, that's not support. That's normalization of occupation and of genocide. You know, disgusting people, these politicians. Bunch of grifters. You know, they think because there's been, you know, such a mass movement of protests and whatever else, you know, because they see now that there's like at least 1 million people or more who support Palestine, now they want to, you know, try and position themselves to be these, you know, apparent arbiters of what's good and what's moral and what's ethical. But you can still go and look on their website and you can still find, I think it was the day after October 7th, their condemnation of Hamas and their condemnation of the Alaska flood. You know, anyone who condemns these sort of things, you know, they're normalizers at the end of the day. They're people who are in bed with colonialism and empire. And that is the fact at the end of the day. Nobody who has actual morals and ethics, nobody who has actual proper values, sits there and condemns are people who have been subjected to giant open-air concentration camps and starvation and occupation displacement. Nobody condemns them for daring to fight back and daring to resist and daring to try and reclaim what is rightfully theirs. You know, their land, their lives, their dignity. Nobody condemns these things unless they're normalizers. Or worse, you know, normalization is the final form of collaboration. We really have to understand this. You know, we can't allow these normalizers to continue with their normalization. And we can't allow these people to continue to be upheld as, you know, these great progressive faces of, you know, what is right and what is moral and what is just, because they're not. They're not at all. You know, I'm happy and I'm proud to say that, you know, organizations like the BPU, which I'm very much involved with, you know, back when everything happened, we didn't come out with condemnations. We came out actually, you know, condoning what had happened. We come out celebrating what had happened. We come out with our full, unequivocal support of the resistance factions. And, you know, we still have that support for them today. You know, we're not going to sit there and condemn anything they've done. Who are we to sit on our moral high horse here in the West and condemn people who have been subjected to decades and decades of occupation and genocide and slaughter by the West? Who are we to condemn them? Who are we to condemn a population who is like majority children or, you know, young adults who have watched their parents and their grandparents being murdered in front of them or being detained and locked away without trial in Israeli prisons? Who are we to condemn them for daring to have a backbone and daring to confront their oppressor? Who's anyone to condemn them? Absolutely disgusting, anyone who does. You either stand with the resistance or you stand against it, and that's the fact of the matter at the end of the day. You know, settler liberalism exists to absorb radical energy and to neutralize it. You know, it doesn't deny the crimes of empire, it just demands that the oppressed, you know, be polite in their opposition within the boundaries of law and civility set by empire itself, even though empire doesn't sit within these same boundaries itself. You know, it's just ways of offering symbolic empathy in exchange for structural loyalty at the end of the day. You know, it loves the movements and conversations and yarns about human rights and peace. You know, anything that sounds moral, but actually leaves power untouched. You know, it is the immune system of colonialism, this liberal normalism and these liberal tendencies I've talked about on this show. You know, protecting the body of empire from infection by real revolt. You know, we need to really consider all of this stuff. And we really need to realize that after 2 years, if people aren't standing with the resistance factions, they're not standing with the liberation of Palestine. They're standing with the normalization of the Israeli occupation. We've got about 4.5 minutes left in this show. I'm going to go to another song to wrap it up. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week at the same time. Until then, have a good one.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.